Welcome to the Friday, January 25th, 2019 edition of the Clemson Dubcast. Quick programming note, after some consultation with loyal listeners out there to the Dubcast, mostly on the TigerIllustrated.com message board, decided to make it a weekly occurrence as opposed to twice weekly, at least until the 2019 football season, and maybe even beyond that. It was kind of a common theme to hear from people who, during the twice a week format, kind of got behind and had to play a lot of catch up. So we will try the once a week method and see how that goes. Certainly the quality will still we will aspire to keep it as high as possible and hopefully beyond. But let us know what you think. We are certainly open to suggestions and not opposed to going back to the twice weekly format. We certainly enjoyed that, but seems like the sweet spot for the listeners might be just one a week. Got a book on the way. Dabo's Dynasty, Clemson's Rise to College Football Supremacy. Had not planned to write another book after doing one, I guess, 3 years ago. But the week before the championship game, the publisher reached out and said, "You want to do another one?" I said, "How about this? I'll do another one if Clemson wins." And lo and behold, Clemson won. And then Wednesday, 2 days after the game, got started, sent in the manuscript, I guess, 6 days later. And as I speak, we are in the final editing stages of the book, which should be out probably late February. So stay tuned for more details on how to acquire that. Title sponsor of the Clemson Dubcast, Parham Smith and Archenhold Law Firm in Greenville. Very happy to have them aboard. Couldn't do it without them. Blake Smith and Brooke Archenhold, both Clemson grads, both huge fans. Forte of their firm is medical negligence. They represent patients and their family members in medical negligence actions. They also handle all sorts of other complex personal injury litigation. I can vouch for them. About 10 years ago, a family member had a pretty serious medical situation with one of the local hospitals, went to Blake Smith, and he very quickly and authoritatively gave us some great advice, and we were very thankful for that. Parham Smith and Archenhold offers free consultations. Give them a call, 864-990-4581 or parhamlaw.com. Business owners out there, if you own a business that accepts credit cards, you need to listen up. Tandem Payment, based right here in the upstate, run by Clemson folks, is changing the face of payment processing, quickly becoming the most cost-effective solution for all small businesses. Tandem's program saves you up to 90% on processing charges and gives your customers what they love most, choices. This is not some crazy introductory offer. Tandem's technology allows business owners to offset their credit card processing costs by applying a small customer service charge to each sale they make. If you want to know more, visit TandemPayment.com today. Former Tiger Hot Rod McDowell works over there at Tandem Payment. They handle all their business and customer service face-to-face. So give them a call, 864-672-1570, if you're tired of spending an arm and a leg on all those credit card processing fees. Okay, for this week's podcast, we're going to have two guests. Two guests who are very familiar with Alabama football and Nick Saban and all the inner workings of that monster of a program. Chris Lowe, national college football writer, and Aaron Suttles, Alabama beat writer for a decade. Just wanted to get a finger on the pulse of what it's like over in Tuscaloosa right now with the program, the fan base, the reaction to getting just dismantled for the first time in forever under Nick Saban. How are they reacting to not just the championship game and what happened that night, but also what happened in the days thereafter when Nick Saban had to deal with yet another exodus of assistant coaches. So just trying to get a lay of the land from two authorities on Alabama about the fallout from what happened in part four of this incredible postseason college football rivalry that is showing really no signs of ending. So here we go. We'll start with Chris, and then thereafter we will transition to Aaron Suttles. Enjoy. Joining the Dubcast for a second time, my good friend Chris Lowe of ESPN.com. Really appreciate you joining us, Chris.
Larry, it's good to be with you, man.
All right. Did not get a chance to visit with you at either of the playoff games Clemson was in. You didn't make the trip to Dallas or Santa Clara, so we missed you. But I know you were monitoring all the developments from afar, and I just got to ask. I mean, this game is more than 2 weeks old, but it still reverberates, and it will continue to, just because you don't see something like that very often. What was your reaction as you were watching Clemson really take it to an Alabama team that's not used to having it taken to, if that makes any sense?
Well, and I certainly wasn't floored that Clemson won. I mean, I knew Clemson was good enough and talented enough. It would not be in any way, shape, or form intimidated to be on that stage. But it's the way they beat him. It's not, Larry, that they beat him. It's that they beat him up. I think that was the surprising part to me. And then Alabama looked at times just out of place. When's the last time we've seen Alabama on that stage? I mean, they've gotten fortunate over the years to have the ball bounce their way to get into the playoff and to get into some of the BCS stuff. Even Saban would tell you that. But when they've gotten there, they've always played A football. And that was, again, what was surprising to me, is that they looked out of sorts in a number of different areas. Clemson looked better prepared, more confident, just better across the board. I mean, that's, again, what none of us are used to seeing with a Nick Saban team, especially when they have some time to prepare. Now, they didn't have as much time to prepare for this game as they did the first game, you know, the semifinal. But I think that was the surprising part to me, because I knew Clemson, having been around that program and knowing Dabo, that they'd be ready to go. And if they played well, would certainly have a chance to beat them. But I did not expect them to beat them up like that. I guess that's the only game Saban's ever lost to Alabama by more than 14 points, which is pretty telling.
Yeah, we have so much clarity now in hindsight as we're diagnosing that dismantling. I mean, you think back to some of the signs that lurked sort of beneath the surface and beneath, you know, that pyrotechnic offense with Tua. You think back to the regular season when Arkansas put up 30-something points against that defense. You think to Missouri having some success in the downfield passing game. Maybe a couple of others. You think, well, actually, on the other side of the ball, you recall Mississippi State's defensive front flustering Tua some. You recall Auburn's offense in the first half going up and down the field. And then the most glaring warning sign, I think, and the most recent going into that national championship game, the second half against Oklahoma when, and, you know, I didn't watch it closely because I was working, but I remember talking to Paul Meyerberg of USA Today in San Jose a couple of days before the championship. I said, who do you think is going to win? He said, I think Clemson's going to win. He said, this Alabama defense is so undisciplined and we're making so many mistakes that were uncharacteristic of Alabama in the second half of that game in the Orange Bowl. And, you know, all that stuff looms so large now that we know they had some fundamental issues on defense, fundamental issues that are fundamental against a team like Clemson. Did you see some of those cracks going in enough to think that it could spell Alabama's doom or to make their defense looking somewhat like it did against Clemson.
Well, not only did I see him, the head coach at Alabama saw him back in the preseason when I visited with him. He told me, I mean, his direct quote to me was, "Chris, we're going to be a different kind of team this year. We're just not as good defensively. We're not going to be as dynamic defensively. We're going to have to win games where we have to, you know, really outscore people and getting these shooting matches. We're not used to that, but that's the way we're going to have to win this year." And you go back to the season, he was right on several occasions. And I think when you look at, they lost their best pass rusher in the preseason, Terrell Lewis. So, they've always had at least one or two guys that were dynamic pass rushers off the edge. So they lost him. Christian Miller, who, you know, the kid from Columbia, Corey Miller's son, really played well this year and was a solid, consistent pass rusher for him. Well, he hurt his hamstring in the semifinal. They'd hoped he could get back, but he was not able to get back. That hurt him. So I think when you couple that with the fact that Alabama had lost so many good players earlier the last couple of years on defense, they just weren't the same. And you did see, Larry, flashes throughout the season where it showed up. But let's be honest, they did not face a quarterback like Trevor Lawrence or a receiving core like what Clemson had. They just hadn't faced anybody close to that. And so when you, again, add that to the equation of the fact that they just weren't talent-wise or personnel-wise what they had been, then, yeah, as I said earlier, I thought Clemson would, you know, certainly had a chance to win. I didn't think they would beat them as badly as they did. But you're right, looking back at it, you know, it does sort of add up, because Trevor Lawrence, his ability is to throw every pass, to stretch the field, to spread it around, and Clemson's ability to get down the field. I'll say this, I talked to Jimbo Fisher before the game. Of course, Jimbo and A&M played both teams, and he said, "You watch, Clemson will make plays down the field because they've got Lawrence and they've got the receivers, big guys who can separate and go get the football." And he was right. You know, Clemson made several of those plays and really exploited Alabama.
Did he think Clemson was going to win?
He said he thought it could go either way, but he was having to face both teams. He said that was the area where he saw Alabama was really most vulnerable, and he was right. But and he sort of went back and forth, but he felt like Clemson definitely had a chance to win. The other thing is, I don't think any of he felt like this, and I did too. He wondered how well Clemson would be able to hold up in pass protection against Alabama, and as it turns out, they were great. You know, that to me, everything else that happened in that game, the story of that game was how good Clemson was in protecting Lawrence and holding up the offensive line, everything, blitz protection. They were outstanding in that area. And I think that's, to me, that was over and above how good Lawrence was and receivers and everything else. The protection was outstanding.
Yeah, no doubt. Absolutely no doubt. That was the most surprising development, I guess, in that game, because, I mean, this is the same Alabama defensive line that a year earlier just absolutely whipped Clemson up front in the Sugar Bowl. And then, oh, by the way, they add the best defensive lineman in the country in Quinnen Williams. So, yeah. I mean, now some of those throws didn't take a whole lot of time to develop, but when that game was still close and Clemson needed to continue moving the ball and scoring, there were several times where Lawrence didn't just have time. He was able to step up into the pocket and deliver. And that's just something that, honestly, I did not see coming either.
No, I don't think anybody did. And that was, again, one of the things that Jimbo, as he was sort of going down the checklist of things to watch for, that was where he was most concerned for Clemson. You know, if they'd be able to hold up in pass protection, just like he felt like that Alabama was vulnerable. And I think his words were, you know, they're pretty mortal at corner. And don't have those edge pass rushers they've had in the past. And as it turns out, the concern for Clemson really wasn't a concern because they were outstanding again up front protecting it. And that, to me, was the story of the game.
Okay, Chris, you're obviously much closer to Nick Saban than most in the media. You have a good read on him. This latest exodus of assistant coaches, by my count, five, I guess, as of press time here at 1:18 p.m. on Wednesday afternoon on January 23rd. Is this cause for alarm, genuine concern, slight concern, or none of the above?
I think it's probably somewhere in the middle, and I think probably it's worth pointing out that this is more than he's had in the past. I think there could be as many as seven when it's all said and done that leave. But when you go back over the last 4 years, Larry, I think he's had at least four every year leave to go elsewhere. And when you look at the numbers, well, I think there's a couple things. First of all, Nick Saban's not for everybody. As a player, as an assistant coach, you know, he can be a bear to work for. He'll tell you that. You know, he's demanding, he runs. You know, some people just aren't cut out for that. And, you know, sometimes guys come in and think, you know, and I think a lot of times guys come in and see Nick Saban, and, oh, man, this is going to be my chance to come and get under his tree, go get a head job in a year or two. And it doesn't work out as quickly as they think. They're ready to get out of there. I think the other side of that is, of the guys, I think there's, over the last 4 years, there's about 16 to 18 that have left. Well, seven of those are now head football coaches in the college ranks. And six more are coaching or left to coach in the NFL. One of those, Steve Sarkisian, is now returned to be Nick's offensive coordinator. So I think a lot of times it depends on how you look at it and make sure you get the whole picture. But listen, anytime you have that much turnover, it's a challenge. You know, just like they've lost, I think over when they lost seven players early this year to the draft, that's 37 early entrants under him.
Cool.
Since he's been there, 37 and 30, I think of the first 30, 17 were first rounders, and they've been able to continue to recruit obviously at a high level and keep on keeping on. So it's not, I don't think it's ideal. Last year, I think he made a conscientious effort to get younger. It was the youngest staff he's ever had at Alabama to help recruiting. I felt like that they would be better, maybe better able to relate to kids on the recruiting trail. I think some of that worked out, some of it didn't. But you look at some of the guys he's bringing back now, you know, a lot of those guys are veteran coaches. Sal Sunseri, who's also coached under Saban previously, you know, returning to the staff. So I think he's trying to mix it up a little bit better, you know, instead of mixing up, balance it a little bit better. But no, I don't – listen, we've all heard the narrative that, well, maybe this is a sign or that there's cracks in the foundation or the dynasty's over. Listen, as long as he's there, as long as he's running the show, they're always going to be swimming in those championship waters. And they're not going to win it every year, but they're going to be right there. And I would be surprised, especially when you look at who's coming back next year. I mean, much like Clemson, when you look at the guy throwing the football to Tua Tagovailoa and that receiving core, they're going to be right there again next year, you know, playing for it, or at least in those waters.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, you know, going into that game, most people assumed it was going to be a close game. And it's amazing how much impact Clemson winning handily inflicted on – it just seems like people now are making these sweeping – conclusions and assuming that it means something for the rest of the ACC and the rest of upper level, higher tier college football. But I mean, the only conclusion you can make about the gap closing, any kind of gap closing after that game, is, hey, Clemson has closed the gap. Everybody else is still everybody else. I mean, Bama and Clemson coaches both — I actually watched this replay of the game a few days ago. Herb Street, I believe it was, or Fowler said, both of these coaching staff, both of the head coaches told us we're going to be even better next year. And so that doesn't change. You know, Alabama is still going to be filthy loaded on offense. So is Clemson. And so I just don't see how this creates some earth-shaking result or trend of now Alabama's vulnerable. I mean, unless everybody out there is going to go get Trevor Lawrence type quarterbacks and Justin Ross type and T. Higgins type receivers and all that, I just, you know, it just doesn't seem practical to me. You agree?
Well, I mean, Bama was 14-1 this year. And so, I mean, when you start talking about it, they're vulnerable. I mean, they lost to a really talented, well-coached football team that's won two of the last three national championships. You know, those two teams, I guess, are 2-2. They've each won two championships in the last 4 years. So I do think it's everybody else chasing those two programs. And have thought that for a while. And you look at the way they've been constructed, Larry, both these programs mirror each other greatly, a lot more so than they don't. When the way they've been built from the inside out, so they've been able to go into other states and recruit great players. You know, and both head coaches, even though they're different types of personalities, both head coaches work the recruiting trail hard. I mean, they go all over the place. They visit. They enjoy it. And I think in their own way, they connect. I mean, I know it's hard to believe. Chris Saban jokes all the time. Everybody thinks I'm a Tullivan, but you can't recruit the way he does without going to the kids' homes and relating, connecting with kids, parents, and grandparents. And he's done that, you know, and I think we see the Saban throwing his headset on the sideline and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, behind the scenes, those guys like playing for him. You know, they go out, do his boat. His boat thing every spring, every summer. There's a real connection there with him and his players, a different maybe type of connection than what Dabo has. I don't think anybody in the country connects to different types of people better than Dabo does. But Saban does it a lot better than people give him credit for. But no, I think these two programs are, without question, they've widened that gap. The two of us have talked off the, when we've had conversations. Look at how many games these two teams have won in conference over the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, it's 90%. Each team, I think, has won 90% of its games against conference foes in the last 3 or 4 years. It's mind-boggling how dominant these two teams. And look at their games against ranked foes. Clemson's been unbelievable against ranked foes. So has Alabama. During that stretch. So I don't think it's just that, you know, that Alabama has dropped a notch or two. I think Clemson's program has gotten to that point where Clemson and Alabama both are on par and everybody's chasing them.
Yeah, Alabama over the last 4 years in the SEC, 33-2. Number two on the list is Georgia at 24-10. Over in the ACC, Clemson is 34-2 over the last 4 years. Number two on the list is Miami at 21-12. And yeah, so the gap doesn't seem to be getting smaller in that respect, because it's not like Clemson and Bama are going to stop recruiting. Wanted to ask you about the coaches' departures. You know, Nick Saban, even though he's hard to work for, he treats his coaches well in terms of you don't hear about him firing an assistant coach. You just hear what I assume is he quietly says, hey, you might need to look for something else. And then you hear about that coach leaving and taking another job soon thereafter. Do you think that might have been in play with any of these coaches who left?
Yeah, and that's, I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of the times when you see coaches leave his program, it's not always they're trying to get away from Nick Saban. He wants to make a change, because like all great coaches, even when they have great seasons, they're in the playoff, you know, he's trying to get better. You know, he sees somebody else out there he wants to get, or he sees a part of his team that's not playing to the level he wants to play at, or somebody that's not recruiting. He's going to bring somebody else in. So a lot of times, you're exactly right, Larry. He'll say, listen, start looking for another job. I want you to give you a heads up. See if you can find something else out there. See if there's something else out there that's for you. I will help you find something. And he does a lot of times. I don't remember the last time he's come out or Alabama's come out and announced that they were not retaining this coach or they were firing the coach. He will instead encourage him to find something, oftentimes help him find something somewhere else. And I think that's probably, there's at least, as I look down the list of guys leaving this year, I'd say there's at least three on the staff that are doing that. And there's a few that Eno's thing was weird, him leaving and not telling Saban. I think Dan Eno's probably decided that he just wasn't wired or wasn't in his best interest to be Saban's offensive play caller. You know, Brent Key goes from being their line coach at Alabama to Georgia Tech, but he's working for Jeff Collins, his best friend. You know, so there's a connection there. You know, so I sort of understand that. Josh Gattis gets the OC job at Michigan. Calling plays at Michigan. I mean, that's one you're not going to turn down. Loxley's the head coach at Maryland. You know, so there's several like that I understand completely. Tyus Lipoy going to the NFL with the Browns. You know, I don't know that Tyus called defensive play. I think he called some of them, but I think Pete Golden called a lot of them too this year. I think it was sort of a team effort, and maybe towards the latter part of the year that Golden maybe called more of them. So there's always situations like that where I think he is behind the scenes instead of trying to be front and center and say, hey, I'm going to fire this guy, trying to help a guy with his career, knowing that maybe it's not a fit there, but he's trying to help him go somewhere else. So, yes, that does happen.
You mentioned that a year ago when Saban had to fill six spots, that he went heavily in favor of the younger types who were really proven or established on the recruiting trail. Is the feeling that philosophical decision sort of came at the expense of game day scheming and adjustments and all that?
Well, I just think he's looking for probably more balance, recruiting, coaching balance. And I mean, let's face it, when's the last time Alabama hasn't recruited pretty well? Now, they've had some years that, you know, maybe they were better than others, but gosh, they went a bunch of years in a row where they were one or two, whatever the rankings are worth. I think there's some of that, yeah, that maybe on the field, development, guys getting better. Maybe they sacrifice some of that. But then you look at Mike Loxley, for instance. Look at the offense this year, the numbers they put up. And now, they didn't do it against Clemson. They didn't finish drives, and uncharacteristically. I thought that was the only game all year. I saw Bama a bunch live this year. And I saw Clemson several times as well. That's the only game I saw Tua Tagovailoa, Larry, where it looked a little bit big for him, you know, at times. And a lot of that's, you know, Clemson, Brent Venables came after him. It's in a lot of different looks. Clemson's got, what, four or five pros at some point in that defensive line, even though Dexter Lawrence didn't play. So even you subtract him, at least three or four. But I think that may be a part of it. And he's probably trying to get it right, trying to get that right mix, that right balance, and you know, guys that can recruit, but guys that also can coach. You know, but they're both these teams are going to be right there again. I'd be very, very surprised if both teams are in the playoffs again this year. First of all, I don't see anybody in the ACC that has a chance to challenge Clemson. I really don't. And I think in the SEC, you know, there's some teams that are getting better. Certainly Georgia. You know, Georgia has been right there each of the last 2 years. You know, they lost to Alabama championship game 2 years ago, and the SEC certainly had their chances this past year. So, in Georgia, and I think A&M under Jimbo Fisher is moving in the right direction, as well as Florida under Dan Mullen, so the way they finished the season. But I still think both these teams, I was kidding somebody today, I said, you know what, maybe they're going to rename the college football playoff the Clemson-Alabama Invitational. Both of them seem to be there every year.
So you mentioned something really interesting that Saban said to you before the season that they were going to have some issues on defense. And to compensate for that, they were super aggressive on offense because they knew they had to score a bunch of points. Do you see perhaps maybe some scaling back a little bit from the offensive standpoint as far as their aggression, just given that more aggression, you know, means more touchdowns, of course, when you're just flat out better than the people you play. But against a team like Clemson, more aggression also means more risk in terms of taking chances and having balls picked off and ball on the ground from your quarterback. Do you see what I'm saying?
No, I think they'll go back to doing a little bit more of what Sarkisian is comfortable with. But I've had enough conversations with Saban to know that they're always going to do what their personnel best does. And when you've got Judy and Devontae Smith and that crowd of receiver, and you got Tua Tagovailoa throwing the football to them, they're not going to line up and run the ball 35 times a game. They're going to throw it. But they're also, Saban believes deeply in being able to run the football as well, too. Now, they're losing. You know, I know Josh Jacobs was about as good a running back as I saw. And I know people at Clemson will say, wait a minute, we had a pretty good one, too. But as far as a guy that could play on every down, mm-hmm. and make an impact on every down, could catch the ball, could protect and run it, you know, and they're losing him. You know, he's leaving. So I think that's going to be a bigger loss for Bama than maybe a lot of people would think. But there's still some young ones. They've recruited well at that position. But no, Larry, I don't think there's going to be a dramatic departure from what they did, because let's face it, you got a guy like Tua Tagovailoa and the receiving core he has, you'd be crazy not to feature those guys.
No doubt. Last question. Your takeaway after Clemson's last two national championships, how was your takeaway different this time compared to 2 years ago when they drove down the field and won it at the end?
Well, I said this and I wrote it back when they lost to Alabama in 2015. In fact, wrote a story this spring about it, sort of following up on it. And I was very clear. I said, listen, even though they lost, I said, they'll be back. What Dabo has built a program to last. And that's exactly what he's done. I mean, it's not like 1 year they're going to win 13 or 14, and next year they're going to drop to 8. My opinion of the program and what Dabo's done there is, it's not, as long as he's there, much like Saban of Alabama, they're going to be right there. And again, and this is not, I know some people will hear what they want to hear. This is not really a knock against the ACC. I just think it's more that Clemson's run off and left everybody in that league. I just don't see, I mean, do you see anybody in that conference right now that really has a great chance to challenge them?
Chris, Rivals.com, our national writer, Mike Farrell and Adam Gorney did a look at the 5-star acquisitions team by team in the last 4 full recruiting cycles of the ACC. And Clemson had, I believe, 15 total. Florida State 11, I believe, over those 4 years. Then Miami 3. And that's it. So 11 ACC schools have combined to accumulate a goose egg, a combined 0 5-star recruits over 4 years. And so, yeah, no, it's, I mean, that's part of the reason we've, it's January 22nd or 23rd, and we're sitting here talking about, a lot of what we're talking about involves the next matchup between Clemson and Alabama. I mean, nobody in the ACC moves the needle, really, in the same way that nobody except Georgia moves the needle when you're talking about Alabama's dominance of the SEC.
Yeah, and both teams, you're right, both teams. And you know what, you're going to look at Oklahoma and the Big 12, and you're going to see a very similar run for Oklahoma over the last 2 or 3 years. They've dominated record-wise in the Big 12. And I do think there's a few more in the SEC that will have a chance. At least, as I said, Florida, I think, Texas A&M, let's see what those programs do over the next couple of years. Georgia, we know what Kirby's built there. But I'd be very, very surprised if we don't see Clemson and Alabama going at it again next year, either in the semifinal or the championship game. I just think both programs are at that point, and I don't think there's a lot of other schools out there right now. There are a few, but not a lot that can take them down. And I think it's a testament to getting the right coach. When you get the right coach at the right time and a guy that and a school that's invested. And I say this all the time about Clemson. And I'm reminded every time I go there, Larry, is you talk about a place where they got everybody rolling in the same direction, from the president to the trustees to the boosters to the head football coach and everybody on staff there. I mean, you go through the Reeves complex, that place is unbelievable. And just the vibe in that complex of doing everything possible and moving everybody, moving in the same direction. And that's why, you know, Clemson's built what they have. And it's very similar to Alabama too. And I don't, you know, I guess, and there's other places, I'm sure. I think A&M's got that too a little bit now. Hasn't always had it. And that's why, I mean, I'll be interested to see what Texas A&M does over the next few years. So we'll see. But I know a lot of people had a lot of different takes about Clemson, Alabama. It's bad for college football. It's boring. To me, that's hogwash. They're the two best teams. I want to see the two best go at it. And I love seeing excellence. And those two programs have defined excellence over the last 4 years.
Yeah, when they did the 30 for 30 on the Lakers and the Celtics, they didn't do it because it was boring.
Right. No, and it's UConn women's basketball. I mean, you go back to the UCLA men's basketball dominant in the 70s under Wooden. I mean, there's been a lot of these. And probably the best analogy is the one you bring up, you know, the Celtics and the Lakers. It was every year. But, boy, you look forward. I mean, you're talking my time in the NBA now. I look forward to those matchups. And I look forward to seeing Bama and Clemson go at it again in college football.
Chris Lowe, always great conversation. Really, really appreciate you joining us for the second time.
You bet, Larry. Always a pleasure.
Proud sponsor of the Dubcast is the Abernathy Boutique Hotel. A short Trevor Lawrence throw from Death Valley. Man, it is a favorite for the ESPN folks who come into town, who stay there various times of the year. Also, man, it is booked up and packed to the gills for home football weekends. It is really caught on for people who want to come in and stay. Also, Taps Bar and Cafe, a really cool spot to go hang out during the week. If you want to grab a drink with some friends, some of you professors out there who want to wind down after work, laid-back alternative to some of the more boisterous college bars in downtown Clemson. So go check them out if you already haven't. Got some really good beers on tap, including my favorite, the Hugie Street IPA. So check them out online at theabernathy.com. All right, let's get to Aaron Suttles of The Athletic. Also, pardon the technical difficulties in the middle of this. That's all my fault. I discovered during the interview, I have a bad cord that's hooked up to my telephone recording apparatus. So going to get that fixed ASAP. But in the meantime, and my apologies again, you're going to have to deal with maybe 30 seconds, 40 seconds of some really annoying sounds. So prepare yourselves for that, and hopefully that doesn't ruin the experience. Okay, here we go. Enjoy. We are now joined by Aaron Suttles of The Athletic, who has been covering Alabama football for a decade, since 2008. Aaron, great to have you on, man.
I appreciate you having me, Larry.
All right, we had Chris Lowe of ESPN on earlier, and now we have you. Just trying to get a finger on the pulse of what it's like in Alabama world after that beatdown, I guess, 17, 18 days ago. It still kind of reverberates over here, of course, and throughout college football. What is the feeling, I guess, now that there's been some time to digest what went on that night on January 7th?
You know, this is just my perception of it, but I get the sense that Alabama fans are taking it a lot better than they did a couple of seasons ago when they felt like one really slipped away. Like they felt like really one got away when Deshaun Watson led that last second touchdown drive, that they hadn't done everything they could do, and they really felt, I mean, heartbroken. And I think any sports fan can probably make the connection of what it feels like when you have your heart ripped out versus when you just are resigned to the fact that you're beaten. And I mean, Clemson just absolutely beat Alabama a few weeks ago. It's been an odd game to think about because Alabama moved the ball so well, but just could not score the football. I want to say, I think I looked it up at the time, the last, I don't know, something like 41 minutes of the game, they didn't score a point, but they moved the football. So So that one will always be kind of curious to me, is how they had so much success moving the football, but just could do nothing in the red zone. But Alabama absolutely could not stop Clemson. I've not seen an Alabama defense handled that way in a long time. Maybe one of those Ole Miss games with Hugh Freeze there. But to have a freshman quarterback do it and just carve them up was really a sight to behold.
What was your feeling going into the game? I mean, nobody on the planet outside Clemson's locker room was envisioning a beatdown like that. But as you think back, I mean, you know, you have a lot of clarity, of course, in hindsight. You think back to the game against Arkansas when, you know, a really bad Arkansas team puts up 30 plus points. You see Missouri with some downfield, with some success in the downfield passing game. You see Auburn moving the ball in the first half of that game. And then, of course, the second half against Oklahoma, you saw some vulnerability there. Did you walk into that game in Santa Clara thinking that the cracks were that big?
I knew there were cracks. I didn't know they were that big. I mean, even Georgia in the first half of the SEC championship game had a lot of success. But Alabama's offense had masked a lot of those inefficiencies on defense all season long. And we knew Alabama had problems at middle linebacker. It was evident really from the year before when they really had so many injuries. And then when they lost Sean Deion Hamilton or Sean Evans, they left for the NFL, and it really fell on a true sophomore, Dylan Moses, and Mac Wilson. People had hope, but they saw that there were some vulnerabilities there. And, you know, I think for a large part of the season, Quinn and Williams also masked that defense that, you know, he kind of came out of nowhere and right in the middle of a defense to be able to disrupt offenses the way he was so quickly, he masked a lot of that too. So I don't think anyone saw it coming like that. And tip your hat to Clemson, because they made every play. And a lot of those plays were made by a guy from Alabama, and Justin Ross, and what a phenomenal talent he was. But you're right. No one – we knew that the defense had slipped, but no one foresaw that. I mean, I think I had the game in the 30s, so I knew Clemson was going to put up some points. When I look back at that game, I'll always remember Alabama only scoring 16 points.
Yeah. I mean, Brent Venables, you probably were there and heard him on media day 2 days before the game. I mean, I couldn't figure out if he was doing the hangdog thing as a motivational ploy, or whether he was talking Alabama up like Darth Vader because it was actually true. But after the game in the locker room afterward, he said, that's the best offense I have ever faced, slightly better probably than the 2004 Southern Cal offense that put up 55 against Oklahoma with Matt Leinart and Reggie Bush and Lindell White and a host of other elite players. So, yes, I agree with you that, you know, it wasn't unreasonable to think that Trevor Lawrence and Clemson's offense was going to put up points, but goodness gracious, 16 points against that offense is an absolute masterpiece.
It really might be the lead paragraph when Brent Venables finally hangs it up, because I recognize all the talent that Clemson has on the defensive side of the ball, but I just covered that team all season long. I just, if Alabama played Clemson 50 more times, I don't think they could do that. It was just the way that game came together. I think Alabama played a hand in that Alabama, if you go back and watch, they, especially on offense, they weren't very patient. Mm-hmm. If you go back and watch the LSU game, or even the Mississippi State game, when they didn't have success on offense, they started to press a little bit, and they weren't patient, and I think that bit them a little bit, and they panicked. I mean, I'll still There are a couple of play calls that I just don't understand. A quarterback sweep to the short side of the field with Tua Tagovailoa on a fourth down against that Clemson defensive line with nothing built in that the quarterback could check out of if they had that covered. That makes no sense to me. That truly, truly awful fake field goal makes no sense to me. And I think that showed Alabama panicked. I think they knew early on, we can't stop Trevor Lawrence. We can't stop Etienne and Justin Ross and all those guys. We're going to have to score a lot of points. And I think they showed that early on, even in the second quarter, I thought they were pressing. And to that regard, I think, you know, Clemson got in their head a little bit.
I want to propose a theory, and you can tell me if it's crazy or not, but you know, the notion of Alabama being just wiped off the field was such a foreign concept going into that game. But if you think back to the two games against Georgia, the national championship, of course, and the SEC championship this past season, there were pivotal junctures in both of those games where it felt like things were about to implode for Alabama. And I'm thinking, and I know you remember, in the national championship, you had the guy whose name I can't place right now, like getting in a fight on the sidelines or whatever, bickering with coaches when they were down double digits. And then, of course, in the SEC championship, Alabama's down, 14 points, and it feels like they're on the verge of falling apart. I guess what I'm saying is, in both instances, had Georgia been able to get another score, my theory is that the result could have unfolded somewhat similar to the way it unfolded against Clemson. Do you see what I'm saying? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. It's you mentioned it's being so foreign. I never expected Alabama not to fight back in the national championship game. I think they tried again. They moved the football well. They just could not. They were allergic to the end zone, and they could not find a way to get in the end zone. If they score on a couple of those drives, I think that game turns out different. I was most shocked to see how Clemson ended the game. At that point, we all knew it was over. But to just manhandle Alabama and keep the ball as long as they did, and I think a few guys on that defense absolutely quit, was surprising to me, because we're just not – it's just Alabama had never lost by more than 14 under Nick Saban. Even in the beginning part of that dynasty in 2007, and that wasn't a very good football team, nobody beat him by more than 14. So, hats off to the effort that Clemson coaching staff put up and those guys, because they really put it on them and they never let up.
Coaching turnover is certainly not foreign in Tuscaloosa under Nick Saban, but is this just more of the same? Is there any concern, alarm over this most recent round of it?
I think some people – I was talking to a good source of mine, and he put it perfectly. He said, Alabama needs something positive to happen right now, which sounds so foreign to people outside Alabama. Like, well, how much more positive do you need? I mean, given all the programs accomplished in the last decade or so. But to his point, getting blown out in the national championship game, having a coach skip town on you in the middle of the night, losing another coach that you wanted to keep to Michigan, and in the way the some of the coaching staff turnover is gone, the perception is that it needs something positive to happen. I think a lot of these coaching moves that you're going to see have been orchestrated by Nick Saban, a couple by guys getting jobs and opportunities at other places. But the majority of them are orchestrated by Nick Saban, and he's doing so. I think he learned a lesson last year that he needs some experience on that coaching staff. That's why you see him bringing Charles Kelly and Sal Cincere and some guys like that, guys that he trusts. So, but I think with National Signing Day around the corner, I think they're really looking for some positive momentum if they can finish off a number one class, just so they can get this perception that everything's going against Alabama right now. And I don't think it's really that way, but we all know in life there's reality and there's perception. And sometimes perception becomes reality because so many people think it almost becomes true, even if it's not. So in that world, Alabama does need something positive to happen. And if they can finish off a number one recruiting class, I think that would be it.
And I guess you could argue that that turnover, the coaching turnover, hurt them the most in the form of that number eight on the other side of the ball, because Justin Ross said multiple times that the reason he left and went to Clemson is he felt like Clemson's assistants were going to be there, where Alabama is having like a, you know, the constant sort of turnstile in its ranks. But I guess it if Alabama is still reeling in the five stars as they are, there's really, I guess, probably no reason to panic if you're Alabama relative to the rest of the SEC, I guess, and everybody not named Clemson in those terms.
Yeah, you know, I know, you know, you can bring up a good point, because that's 2 years in a row now that Alabama will not sign the top-rated recruit in the state. Obviously, Justin Ross went to Clemson, and then Clay Webb is headed to Georgia. And Alabama really thought they had Justin Ross. They were shocked when he went to Clemson. In fact, so much so, they kind of slow played a kid in Tuscaloosa who had a really good freshman all-SEC season at Auburn, Seth Williams. So that speaks to how much they wanted Justin Ross and what kind of chance they thought they had at him. But no, I think things will be fine. I think when you lose, there's an opportunity for growth, and you can look and you can point fingers. But that's not really Nick Saban's style. I think he knew that Clemson was a better team that night in the way they performed. And, you know, he said after the game, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said he was really worried about whether his defensive backs could cover Clemson's wide receivers. And so, you know, he knows that's an issue going forward. It was pretty inexperienced secondary last year. And, you know, he'll use that experience and use that failure, if you want to call a 14-1 season and national runner-up at SEC championships a failure. But they'll use that failure as kind of fuel to get going for 2019.
You alluded to Dan Enos leaving in the middle of the night. Obviously, your colleague Bruce Feldman with quite a bit of a bombshell there, where they're having a staff meeting. Enos is gone, and Saban's, where in the expletive is Dan? What was your take on that revelation?
Yeah, I'd heard it was, I wasn't going to write it, but I had heard the same story that Nick Saban and Dan had basically come to kind of a verbal agreement that, you know, you're going to be my guy. Once the season ends, we'll take care of you. And then in the middle of the night, you know, Dan Enos had come back in and cleaned out his office, and he was expected in a staff meeting the next day. They were getting ready to conduct interviews for some of the positions coaches that were coming available, and Dan Enos wasn't there. And someone had to break the news to Nick that, yeah, he's gone. His office is completely cleaned out. And that's absolutely 100% true. You know, Dan Enos has now famously gone on Twitter and said he didn't leave his employer with no notice. And, you know, while it may be true, he might have sent an email to somebody along the chain, Nick Saban did not know. And so we can get into semantics and argue about that all day long. But it went down the way Bruce Feldman portrayed it in that story. It was very, very bizarre. And again, that's one of the reasons why, if that plays out publicly the way it has, that maybe some people will start looking at Alabama and say, you know, what's going on there? When in reality, it's not that much different than previous seasons. It just played out publicly.
Maybe he could say that the notice came in the form of the pencil that was sitting on the desk in the empty office. Aaron, I'm interested to know or to get a feel for how Alabama fans view Dabo Swinney now. Because, you know, they've always loved him, of course. And, I mean, that was represented in the fall of 17 when he came back for that reunion of the 92 national championship, and he got a fabulous ovation from the entire stadium at Bryant-Denny. But it's a little easier to love somebody when they're not ripping your heart out and beating you by four touchdowns. Do you sense that that the view of him is any different than it was before January 7th?
You know, it's a good question, and I really don't. I think sometimes when you've been close to someone, you had a relationship with them, and they leave on not great terms, or maybe you realize in retrospect they're not who you thought they were. I think with Dabo Swinney and his perception, the way he comes across to people who've never met him, that just have formed their characterization of him through what they've seen on television and in interviews. And then there are people who've really met him that it lines up, that this guy is – there's so very little people who are who, and I don't want to say completely because no one's perfect, but who are very thoroughly genuine. I think we all in this world of social media, we all put our best foot forward, right? Like, we don't want to put a picture up and it makes us look great. And let's use a filter here. And I'm going to take a, you know, I'll let everyone know when I'm going on this great vacation, or I just bought this great house or car. And so we live in this world where we're projecting our best selves all the time. Dabo seems to live up to that. And I'm not saying he's flaunting any of his wealth, or, and that's not what I'm going here. I'm just saying the guy who he talks and you hear him tell stories, that's him. And, yeah. And I think people really, really recognize genuine. And I'm not going to use this opportunity to poke fun at any coaches who've talked similarly and haven't lived up to it, but it's pretty obvious. There are people who talk but don't necessarily walk the walk, and I think in some respects we're probably all guilty of that. But it's hard. You have to work. I think you have to work to find a reason to dislike Dabo Swinney. Now you're right that if he keeps continuing to whoop your tail, you may form a little dislike of him, but. That hasn't circled its way. But I mean, we talked to Alabama fans on the radio 5 days a week, and that just hasn't been a topic of how much they hate the guy. Now, they're not fond of Kirby Smart. They don't like some of the stuff Kirby Smart's doing. But they respect, and there's a real love for Dabo Swinney. And I think that we can all sense that he's just a good guy. I mean, it's just what it comes down to. He's just a good guy.
So it's interesting, your sense comparing the Clemson's win 2 years ago versus now is that then they felt like they were this close to winning it all, whereas now they're like, yeah, Clemson was just better, and they can accept that, I guess.
I think so. I mean, it's been – none of my teams that I actually root for, I'm a Tampa Bay sports fan, so my teams are all dreadful. So it's been a while since I've had the emotion of having my heart ripped out, but – you know, I remember what it feels like, and it stinks and it hurts, and you can't sleep that night. And you think about it, your mind keeps playing over the key portions of games over and over again. But when you get beat, I mean, I sleep a lot easier just knowing you weren't good enough. I mean, I think Nick Saban will always be haunted by the 2016 national championship game. Just the way the game played out, with the best defense that you've ever had on the field with a lead in basically 2 minutes and you couldn't get it done. I think that will always haunt them. I don't necessarily think this is the case. I don't think Alabama played particularly well on offense, but even if they had, who knows if they win a shootout, because Clemson was scoring at will. I mean, you would have had a shot, but I don't think there's any given that you win that game, even if your offense is clicking.
Yeah, I've told people that if Christian Wilkins and Cleveland Farrell and Austin Bryant don't decide to come back a year ago and Clemson gets to that championship game, that score is probably 68-60 with 8 missed extra points combined.
Most of them by Alabama.
Aaron, it's been great getting to know you over the last 4 years, and let's just go ahead and plan to meet again in New Orleans next year.
Absolutely. Round 5. Let's do it.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate you being with us.
Thanks. Thanks, man.
Okay. Thanks so much, Darren Suttles, for sharing his time with us. Also, Chris Lowe. Really appreciate all their insight. Really interesting stuff, observations that you can only get from going to the people who are really plugged in and know what they're talking about. So thanks to them. Thanks to our sponsors, of course. Title sponsor, Parham Smith and Archenhold Law Firm in downtown Greenville. Also in Greenville, Tandem Payment. And then last but not least, the Abernathy Boutique Hotel in Clemson. Thanks, of course, and most especially to all of you for making this a part of your routine. Really appreciate it. Stay tuned next week for another one. Everybody have a great weekend. Cheers.